Stupid. This is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio, and I just did a very stupid thing. I actually had the Man Strong podcast on recorder and was not thinking when I hit what I saw on there, which I just was not thinking about this week. I was thinking about the shows that were on there from the last couple of weeks, and I deleted it. So there won't be a Man Strong podcast, even though I apologize to Alan at Funky Trap Tags and Supplies that sponsors that, because I just did a very stupid thing without thinking, and I apologize. But what we talked about was Black Lives Matter. I'm not gonna say whether I think it's good or bad. I think it's just smart to actually see what they say, and then as a man, make a good decision or not, whether you want to support that organization or not. And I thought it was a pretty good show, so it's like double stupid for me. So I will be redoing that one for next week, and I apologize, because that was going to go up today also. But if you hadn't been to Trapping Radio before, we talk about all kind of stuff. We talk about catching fur, we talk about putting up fur, we talk about businesses, we talk about all kind of stuff, just stuff trappers think about quite regularly. And we're going to start with a question today from an audio question from a listener. And he's got some pretty cool ideas in here and a question. And then I want to talk a little bit about anti-fragility and just some things to think about with your trapping. And if we have time left over, we're going to go into some old woofer methods, because it's pretty slick. And the more we know about the past, especially after reading this book, Anti-Fragility, the reason some of these things stay around is because they work, and the reason sometimes newer stuff doesn't stay around because it's not as practical as someone thinks it is. So, before we get into tonight's show, I want to thank our sponsors. We've got the best sponsors in the trapping industry, hands down, honest, dependable. They get your orders out. They keep stuff in stock. They, most of them ship within 24 hours. Just really good people to deal with. And the first one we're going to have today is Dunlap Lures, Jeff Dunlap. He's a good friend of mine. We're going to actually be holding a school this September. You can check it out on my store, PCG store at Woofer Nation, all of the stuff. It's going to be smaller classes. That way, there's never going to be more than six students with either me or Jeff. And we're going to teach you everything that we can in those 2 days. Except for our lures, pretty much everything else is open. So it's going to be based mainly on predators, but if you need work on other stuff, we're going to be at a really nice place with good food, good lodging. You're not going to have to stay in a tent. And we're going to go around and we're going to work on the craft of trapping. Jeff also makes really good lures. He's been a friend of mine for a while. And if he's putting in the bottle, you can trust it. Next, we have F&T Fur Harvesters, everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Most of y'all know F&T. They got a TV show. They show up to conventions when we had conventions. Harry was the one that you saw most of the time. Ralph and Sean are the owners of that company, and you cannot ask for better people to deal with. Just amazing how honest and upfront and straight they are. So if you're looking for a good company that has about anything you'd want, F&T Fur Harvesters is where you need to go. Next, we have Oki Cable and Trap. He's out of Oklahoma. He's got a full line of trapping supplies. He carries a lot of odds and ends stuff. So if you're looking for things like when I need a bunch of buckets, I give him a call. If I need some meat, I give him a call. I bought trapping supplies from him. Just a really good guy. And you never know what he has. So if you're looking for something that may be a little bit unusual, definitely give him a shot. And then we have Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, which is also the sponsor of Man Strong Podcast. And he sells trap tags, of course. He's got a full line of trapping supplies. He's got stuff for catfishing, which is a great time of year to be doing that right now. And then he's got stuff for deer, because pretty soon you're going to need to start figuring out what you're going to do for your deer. He carries Tactical Nuke. He carries other products like that. And he's now making the stretchers, the Sleepy Creek stretchers, and he's making the best 330 and 220 setters that you'll ever use, and that's the Sleep Recruit ones, the aluminum ones with the red handle. I don't have anything else because nothing else comes close. So let's get in tonight's show. Let's start off with the question, because it's a good question and there's some pretty cool stuff in here.
Good morning, Clint. I hope all is well on your end. Got a quick question. You may already have a podcast on it, and I haven't gotten to it yet. Talking about how you trap inside high fences, you know, that have, you know, full of deer or fallow deer or whatever's in that fence. Just kind of curious about how you go upon that. You know, whether you snare the crawl unders or strictly footholds or just, you know, however. But I also thought maybe I could give some ideas, and since it's summertime and trappers are waiting until trapping season rolls back around, it might help them get to thinking, or may just help somebody out, you know, because I like to piddle with things. You know, I used to be real bad about carrying a 2-gallon bucket around full of all kinds of baits and lures that I thought I had to have at all times. And I got tired of carrying that bucket around. So, like with my lure, I'd get Q-tips and dip them like in Boss Dog. And I'd put all those Q-tips I dipped in Boss Dog in one medicine bottle. And I'd do that with all my different lures. And that way, instead of carrying a big jar, now you got the little medicine bottles. You can put them in your pocket, wherever you want to put them. You get to the set, just open the bottle, pull a Q-tip out, put it at set, wipe it at set, however you want to do that. And then, like with my baits, I would take a plunger-style turkey baster, and if you have to nip the end and make it the hole a little bigger, but you can suck most baits that I've ever messed with up in that turkey baster, and take the little white perforated golf balls, the little white ones with the holes through it, and you can actually inject that bait inside that golf ball. And I would take the golf balls and put them, you know, in Ziploc bags, or mainly. And the cool thing about it is, it's good eye appeal, the little golf ball, but you can throw it down a dirt hole. And once you get done with that dirt hole, you can get you a clothes hanger, just a piece of wire with a hook, and stick it down in there, and you can hook that golf ball, pull it back out, and you can use it again. Or like on a flat set even, you can take, I think a 30 penny nail is what I use. I don't remember the size exactly, but it fits right through the holes in that golf ball, and I can actually stake that golf ball straight to the ground. Same concept. And, you know, you get done, you pull it up, put it back in a bag, reuse it later down the road, and that nail, for the most part, will keep the coyotes from taking it from the set, but sometimes they maul them golf balls up. But either way, you got 25 cents for the golf ball. And another one has been one of my favorite things that I thought of. Well, I'm probably not the first one to thought of this, but I use drags 90% of the time, but some of the big fields we have here, I have to stake off, because if not, they'll run and run, or I'm afraid they will anyway. So instead of, to get outside the catch circle, what I would do, I just unhook my drag. I got 10 foot of chain on my trap. I'll unhook my drag, take the J-hook and put it, you know, 3 foot down from the trap in the 10-foot chain with a disposable. Put the disposable on the ground. Once you catch something, if you get outside the catch circle, all you got to do is open the J-hook from the chain, you know, and move back, you know, 6 feet down that chain. Hook your J-hook back up. Now you can move outside the catch circle. And then so on and so forth with your next catch. And after that, for me, it was easier because I didn't have to pull a disposable or unhook that trap and move it outside the catch circle, or have two traps. It, it was just quick and easy for me anyway. So, like I said, I thought maybe I'd just throw a few ideas and get people thinking maybe how they could might improve their line, or you know, maybe that them little ideas right there will help somebody. But anyhow, well, look forward to hearing back from you, and hope y'all have a great summer.
That is pretty freaking smart, James. I've heard about the Q-tips. I played around with doing that. The golf ball idea is very intriguing to me. I will admit that. That is something, it's creative, man. That is super creative. You know, because if you don't make a catch, you just take your bait to the next one, which is not good for a lure maker, but it's good for the trapper, and that's what we're about. It's good for the trapper. But yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And be able to stake that down at a flat set, that's a very versatile type little thing you got going on. I don't know how it handles getting chewed on or not, but I guess maybe to a coyote, if he bites into it, it's just like a big goody jelly bean with stuff come oozes out of it. I'm not sure, but that's really smart about to do that. But what you said was genius was how you handle your catch circles. That I'll admit, that is the slickest thing I've ever heard for somebody set up for catch circles. So if you didn't get what he was saying, I want to reiterate what I think he was saying. So you're in a big field, like, you know, when we're down in Arkansas, and you got really big fields. We're talking, I don't know, 1,000 yards across or something. Big 500, 800 acre fields, and you're nervous about which way the coyote's going to go with the drag. The way I normally deal with that is just run a T-bar down through the end of the drag, but what he's doing is actually pretty smart. So he'll go down on 3 foot of his chain, put a J-hook and put a disposable, drive that in the ground, make a catch. Now, we all know that it's anybody that's ever dealt with mud or rain or thawing snow, once you have a catch circle, it's just a muddy, sloppy, no fun mess. There's coyotes that'll go into that circle, and there's coyotes that'll go around that circle. But if you put your set back on the outside of the circle, whether they're the ones that'll go in the circle or not, now you've got more action to deal with. So when he has a catch circle, instead of pulling that disposable, he just opens up his J-hook and moves it 3 feet down the chain. He can be on the outside, just on the outside edge of the catch circle. When he makes another catch, he just opens up the J-hook, moves it down to the end of the chain. So he can make three catches without having to deal with the mess and not having to deal with pulling his stakes. Brother, that is wickedly smart. And that's a really cool thing. Now, I've talked a lot about the high fence. My theories on this is pretty simple, because when I started out with them, they weren't in Texas, they were in the East. And then when I went to Texas, something became very obvious to me very quickly. A lot of these high fence, they put tremendous amount of money into the genes of these deer. I mean, they artificial inseminate them. They've got deer that the semen is worth to the owner of that deer probably several hundred thousand to $1 million on some of these bucks or does that carry certain genetic types that other people are looking for. So it's not just like I had to worry about accidentally catching a deer. I had to worry about accidentally catching a $200,000 bill. Now, I don't know what would happen, because I never did, but if you were to catch one of these deers, what are you responsible for? I don't really know what that answer is, but the severe consequence of that could be you got to pay for what the thing is worth legally, even if they hired you. So I went about high fence when I started going to Texas a lot different. Now, the way that we run high fences is pretty straightforward. The very first thing we do is we lock up every single crawl under coming in or out of that fence. Now, I want to say something that will shock a lot of you when you think in coyote crawlunders or bobcat crawlunders. We've all seen fences that have these big, beautiful things you can shove a basketball through. They're dug out and dirt's flying everywhere. And you know that that's a coyote. Yes. But the ones that you can fit a softball through or maybe even a baseball through, coyotes and cats go through those just as much as they do those big, beautiful ones. So that's one of the things we learned just over trial and error is if it's a hole that you can put a baseball in, it gets a snare. Which means on bigger properties, you're running hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of snares. But what you'll notice on your catch is you'll catch just as many in the small ones as you do in the big ones. And if you only set the big ones, you're not going to catch the ones going through the small ones. If the hole is big enough for a deer to go through, I will block it down somehow and then set a snare in it. If it's like a lot of the places where you have draws, deer can walk in and out of some of these places, I do not hang a snare in that. Because of the prized value of what the deer is you could be catching. So just keep that in mind. Now as far as footholds, we set the fence, but we never, ever, under any circumstances, no matter what, set a snare inside the fence. And trust me, there are many situations that you'll start getting that little twitchy eye when you see a location that's just screaming for some snares. Do not do it. Because if you do, and you snare one of those deer with a tag in their ear, there could be some real repercussions from that. So no snares. Now, I set a lot of footholds in the fence. So our first part of the operation is get the fence set up. There's a couple reasons for that. One, you get an instant catch for the owner. Two is when you start putting pressure on the coyotes inside the fence and they try to leave. Now you've got them when they're trying to leave. So there's a couple of reasons we do it this way. Footholds inside of the fence, if it's somewhere like around a deer feeder, we're not putting a foothold there. Just the amount of risk escalates when you put it in an active deer trail. So you got to be pretty smart about what you're doing. So you have to apply like a risk analysis the whole time, whether that's what you want to be doing or not. Saying that, I use a lot of traps inside the fences, and I've never had any problems. But I'm not saying that you won't have a problem, or I wouldn't have a problem in the future. At least with a foothold, you can turn it loose. Most deer that snap them off never get caught. It's probably down at less than 1% of deer. It's probably closer to 0.1% of a deer that actually do that. So I've never seen it. I've had problems putting footholds in with some of the hunting type goats. Goats can be an issue. As far as the other ungulates, it's never really been an issue. If you're going to be around these things that are more sheepish or goatish in nature, just because they're highly curious, that's when I would start dropping down, as bad as it hurts my feelings, down to a number two size trap. But that's going to be up to you. Most will still pull out, but you want to be concerned about that. So we set the fence up first. Then we go in and we try to always, by looking at a map, pick a route that goes from one end of the property to the other. And for an example, we're going to say that road goes north and south. It doesn't have to, just north and south. And then once we get that whole line set up, we got from fence to fence inside set up on every single coyote location we can try to figure out. Then we'll look at the opposite direction. If we're going north and south, that'd be east or west. We try to find a road. They don't have to be perfect. They can wind around, they can do anything like that. And then we will set up another line all the way across. And then we always have a few traps in the truck, but just because when you're riding around sometimes, you see things that may not be in the cross. If you kind of see what I'm doing here is making a cross, I'm making quadrants. So no matter which direction a coyote goes inside those fences, he's going to cross my traps. But every now and then you find stuff at water holes or tanks or, you know, where a deer did get killed or something like that, and you see a bunch of coyote sign, then by all means set that up. But it's normally go straight to the fence, and we try to make a cross of traps, four coordinates of traps inside of that fence. And then we spread out from there. That's when we start playing around with putting dog, the FB1s, the FB2 dog proofs at the feeders and the ponds and where we see coon tracks and stuff like that. That's when all that happens, after the initial part gets set up. So that's how we handle high fences. I will say, you can find a bunch of footage of this on my YouTube channel, Woofer Nation. The way we set our fences up with the snares, we use snare supports, we use plastic collars, and we use it's a very efficient system that you ought to go look at if you're looking to do that. That way you're not trying to, you know, tie stuff off. We're using clips instead of running the snare back through the fence. We can set snares on a high fence, be on and out of the Jeep in 30, 40 seconds on most of them. So, if you haven't seen that, go back and look it out on my YouTube channel. It'd be really cool for you. But that's great information, man. That really is. Especially on the golf balls, that's very intriguing. But the way that you did that on the chain in the catch circle, I have to admit, that's country boy serious thinking right there. So I want to talk about being fragile or anti-fragile. Fragility. Don't think it's a real word, but it's a word used in a book I'm reading. And fragile, see if I can say this. I've read it 1,000 times. A fragilist. Fragilista, that's it, fragilista. That's just someone that's really fragile. Now, this is not a Man Strong podcast. Trust me, this is all trapping. But the book is called Anti-Fragile. I'm probably going to be talking to Chip in the next week because I need to put his 4-year degree together, because this is not an easy read. And it is something of a project that me and him have thought about doing here lately, that it's almost like me and Chip need to do a weekly book reading club on this thing, because I think there's some serious, serious wisdom in here, but you got a very egg-headed guy writing it, and it's the words he uses, sometimes things get very confusing. But it's a very simple system of what is fragile and what is anti-fragile. And something that is fragile, if there's any shocks to the system, like most people make plans in a business, they're going to do A, B, C, and D, and they build on each other. Most people are going to lift weights, they're going to lift 10 pounds, 15, 20, and they're going to build on their, you know, the way that it is. The economy is doing this, so you plan off what the economy is doing, and it's kind of linear. Well, it can be very fragile in a linear system, because there's part of that no one ever thinks about, that we're going through right now two different ways in our economy, to show you how fragile linear thinking systems are. If there's any shock to that system, it's not on a linear path at that point. It's very dramatic. Very dramatic. Unemployment is 10%. It's not the same as saying 20% is twice as bad. It's actually about 4 times as bad when you look at the economy. So a shock to the unemployment shows how fragile it is. It actually gets worse when it has some type of scale behind it, and it's something that can't be planned for, like COVID-19. Now we're an extra, $4 or $5 trillion in debt, where was it 30, 40 million people unemployed, businesses are closing down, and then right behind that, you've got all this madness going on with trying to burn cities down. if you had been talking to a financial planner 8 months ago, none of that is in the projections of a linear system of a financial planner, if you follow what I'm saying. So everything's clicking along, 8, 10, 12%, economy's doing good, but no one ever thinks of an epidemic. And look what that one event did to the stock market. Caused us $4 trillion more in debt, and people lost billions and billions and billions of dollars out of their 401ks. One event that nobody planned for. Now you're backing that up with all the rioting and the burning and the looting and all that's going on. So no one planned for COVID, and no one sure as crap planned for the riots right now. Two events and a world stock market and brought it to its knees. That kind of shows you how fragile that is. Now, anti-fragile actually gets stronger with shock. The more volatile something is, the stronger something that's anti-fragile will become. I know this seems like I'm running around in circles here, but just stick with me a second, please. So let's take a lure company, for example, because that's what I am. COVID hits. I'm sitting on 4 or 5 55-gallon drums of glycerin. I actually had a listener tell me about different distilleries that are now selling this denatured alcohol for people to make hand sanitizer out of. I could get that. I've got the glycerin. I'm used to mixing that up. That's no big deal. If I can still get the bottles because of COVID-19, my business could actually be stronger from it. And there's other cleaning products and stuff like me and Carl's talked about, which thank you, Carl. That having the ability to have options. Optionality is something that anti-fragile really likes. Stock market is the complete opposite. They don't want any type of shocks. They don't want anybody to ever be nervous. They don't want to ever think there's going to be a war, a riot, a pandemic, or whatever it is. And as soon as the threat of that becomes real, the stock market crashes and people lose all kind of money. But something that's anti-fragile, just using my business as a hypothetical thing here, I can see the shock, see an option, and roll with it really quick and actually be better off after the pandemic than I was before the pandemic. We were making a joke about hellfire being used on homeless. What if lure makers started making anti-riot skunk, you know, balloons or something? You just order them and people are coming at your store. You make it so nasty for a civilian non-trapper to even get close to that. Most of them will be vomiting. Like skunk is probably not one that I would say would be the best. It actually would be pure SFE. But you can actually have an option to start marketing something for anti-rioting. Stock market just goes down like it did. 1,900 points yesterday or the day before. So being fragile and anti-fragile, the difference is you have options when you're anti-fragile and you don't really have options when you're fragile. When you're fragile, any type of shock to the system gets everything out of whack, exponentially worse than anybody thought it would be. And if you're anti-fragile, you feel the shock, you see the shock, and you come up with options to move around it. And that's not exactly the way the economy for most businesses is built today. So fragile and anti-fragile. So I want to take and just go through some things about trapping. If shocks make you stronger, if you're anti-fragile, let me ask you this question. If you're going to start the season because you're going to need fuel and lure and you're going to lose some setters and you're going to need some new chain and some wolf fangs and some FB1s and some FB2s and maybe a new trowel, stuff like that. So you know there's an expenditure. Are you less fragile or more fragile if you have a nest egg to pull that money out of that doesn't make any difference on your burn rate of your normal life? Your bills, food, electricity, taxes. Or if you use a credit card to do that and a shock happens to the trapping industry, are you more fragile or anti-fragile if you use debt to get this? Well, it should be obvious because that's a very basic one. Debt, you're still gonna have to pay back with interest. And you probably couldn't afford it without using the debt to begin with. And if the market crashes, like it has, you're in bigger trouble. Now, if you use a nest egg, you may not get that back, but it's kind of what it was set there for. So that shock didn't really affect you the same as it was. Because I can tell you back when auto were really high, there were all kind of people maxing out debit cards and pre-selling auto and all kind of stuff up to NAFA. And when the market crashed, it was death and destruction for those guys. For the guys that didn't have to go that route, it was not fun, but it was not destructive. If you're a trapper and the only thing you ever look at is the fur market, do you think you're fragile or anti-fragile? See, what I mean by this, look, say all of a sudden There's a COVID virus and you can't bring in something to a different country like China. So they can't even get the fur to process the fur to get to somebody to make garments or trim out of it. Well, we've all seen what that does. It's very fragile. One company or one country in the fur market can cause devastating results. Now, what if you were a trapper that also looked at the fur market, but maybe you're set up to hold the fur? Are you more fragile or anti-fragile? What if you're also doing some ADC work mixed in with your fur trapping? Are you more fragile or anti-fragile? What if you decide to trade your trapping time and skill and you want to hunt deer and turkey and fish and stuff like that on somebody's property? Are you more fragile or anti-fragile? Well, obviously, the more that you're doing without just that one market, selling glands, tan fur, making pillows, making hats, making quivers for people with their bows out of otter fur, which go for about $200 a piece, you're way more anti-fragile than someone that just looks at the fur market only. Is it more fragile the fewer traps you have out or the more traps that you have out? And I want to give an example here. Let's say you've got a farm, you're running 12 traps, and you're clicking along, you get them all out, you get a couple days running on them, and then somebody runs their dogs through there and it catches a dog. So they go on a jihad to find your traps. They don't find all 12, but they find 10 of them. And they steal them and they crap in your holes and they do all kind of skin your coons and throw the carcass and all that down there just to make you mad. That one unforeseen, and the way the book talks about this is shocks, black swans, whatever the language is you want to use, it's a shock to the system. So you're clicking along with your 12 traps, 10 of them get stolen. It's devastating. Now, what if you're running 100 traps over several farms and the same thing happens on that one farm and 10 traps get gone? Is it more anti-fragile because you're still running 90 traps that can catch, even though you lost the 10. I think it's way more fragile to have the 12 and lose the 10. Because now your percentages are way out of whack. Just some things to think about a little bit. Let's think about your vehicle. If a vehicle breaks down in the middle of trapping season, it's your only vehicle, it's devastating. Most professionals I know can get at their hands on another vehicle in 24 hours. That's what a lot of the guys in the 80s, they would actually have backup vehicles, because when fur was that high, just the cost of not trapping for a week while your truck gets fixed can cost you what the truck cost. So they looked at it very differently than we do today. Now, granted, our vehicles are more, if it's, you know, 10, 15 years old to now, they're a lot more dependable than they were back in the 70s and 80s. But how can we look at something, because if you don't have a vehicle and all your traps are out, now you're trying to get borrow something from a friend or use your wife's car and you're going to get it muddy and dented and scratched and it's not going to be very good. So how do we work, okay, if we're thinking of vehicles, if it can be fragile, how can we make it unfragile? How about just something as simple as a spare tire, a jack, a way to change it? What about breakdowns? So before season, why not go through it and make sure it's running good, you don't have lights on that are saying something's bad, transmission slipping, go and get it fixed, all this type stuff. Have some extra gas. Gas gauges break. 5 gallons can save my butt several times. How about having a, you know, like a handyman jack? If you get your tire off into a draw or something, you can at least jack the back up and put tires under it so you can get level. How about a winch, some snatch blocks? What can you do to make your vehicle more anti-fragile? If you look at everything that you're dealing with your trapping in the terms of fragile and anti-fragile, you start to look at things a little bit different. What about locations? I know a lot of guys that everywhere they go, they sit on the crossroads. Is that a fragile or an anti-fragile way to do locations? I say it's pretty fragile. Because you're of all the different type locations and all the different travel ways of coyotes, that if somebody ignores because they have a pet one, what if someone comes through there with a bulldozer down the main road and runs over half of them, which I've had in Texas? A road grader. Or the coyotes have already had pressure, and we talked about old Crip last week. He didn't walk on roads. The more diverse, the more options you use for locations, the more anti-fragile your trapping is going to be. Fragile and anti-fragile. It's the same as having that small trap line in one area. It's just kind of fragile. A lot of guys have are what I consider to be more of a one-trick pony. Now, they can talk all the lingo about trapping. They've read the books and the demos, and they get in arguments on Facebook, and they do all that. But they're really one-trick ponies if you go with them. They got a certain type of set. Well, I can tell you from being trapping in, I guess, last time I counted, it was like 24 different states. There's places, dirt holes don't work very well for coyotes. And if you're a one-trick pony with dirt holes and you're not proficient in other sets, that makes you very fragile on your trap line. If you've got an idea of what you need to do and you get somewhere and the ground is like asphalt, and the really thing you only know how to do is dirt holes, you're going to kill yourself and have 2 or 3 sets. So it makes you fragile. But if the ground is hard and you're proficient at flat sets and blind sets and portable pockets and you know, Zagger's Pipe Dream set and different things like that, you can just keep rocking on. If you're getting rain every day and the only thing that you know how to do is a dirt hole set, you're going to have a miserable time because your line is more fragile. So you can't be a one-trick pony. Think of everything like, you know, weather's a shock. Freezing's a shock. High wind is a shock. Theft is a shock. All of these. Someone that can roll with the shock is more anti-fragile because they have more options. Let's think about it in a trapping business type format. It is proven over and over and over again that the bigger a trapping business is, the more fragile that trapping business is. Now, from the outside looking in, you go, yeah, but they're making more money. Yeah, they are. They're making more money during good times. But they hemorrhage money when things slow up because they still have to feed the beast. The big business is hungry. The big business has outlays going every which direction. Now, when it's on the steady or up, it's good. But what is the downside? What is the shock with a slower fur market or economy or really bad weather? The bigger the company, the more devastating it is for that shock. A smaller company, it's not as big deal. Why is that? They don't have the out cost going every which direction. They don't have, if you look at a company like, let's say some of the five biggest supply dealers in the country, they probably have $2 to $3 million worth of inventory. So you can get something in 24 hours. And that's with them getting as close to just-in-time inventory as they can get. They got to buy traps by the pallet. See, if you've got pallets of a certain trap, let me make up a name of a trap. Let me look around here. Okay, we're going to call it the CTH. I don't think there's such a thing. I hope there's not. Because there's an old book I'm looking at. It's called Scientific Coyote Trapping and Hunting. So the coyote, the trapping, and the hunting is CTH. So we got a CTH trap. And that's becoming very popular. And we're a big company, so we've got buying power, right? So it means we can buy them cheaper. And we're going to go and we're going to buy 15 pallets of these traps because we sold 14 pallets last year. So we've got 15 traps. We've got the outlay, whether that's through debt or that's the cash flow or however we did that. We're sitting on 15 pallets of traps. And lo and behold, a batch of traps, one batch out of 50 batches made by the CTH company, had some bad rivets in it. And then unbeknownst to you, after you get those traps, these videos start showing up online. And all of a sudden now, nobody wants these traps and you're sitting on 15 pallets of them. See, no one expected the rivets to go bad. That's a shock. The bigger it is, the worse the shock is because of scale. Now, you're a small company. You go to a few shows, you sell a few things online, and you order 4 dozen of these things. No one wants your traps either, but it's not going to hurt you as much either. You can just go use them. Bigger scale breeds more fragileness because you got to do more planning without seeing the shocks. You don't know what the shocks are. You don't know what the repercussions are and all that. So am I telling somebody not to be in a big company? If you want to build that? No, I'm not. But you just need to understand how fragile that can actually be. It's like an ADC business. Nothing in life is linear, even though everybody that teaches business tries to act like it is. So you're a hard charging trapper. In your state, there start being some weird laws passed. You get a little nervous. You still want to trap, so you get your ADC license. You find out there's business booming everywhere around you. You're working yourself to death. You're working long hours. You're making good money. You finally got all the equipment, but you can't get it done. So you kick over to the American dream form of business. Bigger is better. So you get an employee. Now you got a salary. You got to pay, but you're going to be shocked if you've never paid employment tax, what that actually is. So self-employment tax and the federal tax for an employee. Now you're going to have insurance on them, and they're going to have a truck, and that's going to have insurance, and you got to get more traps, and it just builds and builds. So let's say you get this employee, you find out it's not linear the way you thought. So if you're making $100,000 on your own, you get an employee, you're not going to make $200,000. You're probably going to make $140,000, which is still more money. But now you got a lot more money into it. So then you're still getting calls, and you get a second employee, a third employee, a fourth employee. Now you've got a fleet of 10 trucks and 10 employees and 10 sets of gear, and you got to hire more secretaries, and you got to figure out a system, computer system, and transportation and communication, and all this type stuff. And when you look at your books, you would think 10 employees would be 10 times the amount of money, but it's usually going to be 0.4. So you're not making near as much money, and everything's rolling fine, and it's okay. Economy gets all out of whack. Gas prices go through the roof. COVID-19. You're in a city where people think it's okay to loot and burn. And now all of a sudden you have all of this cost with one of those shocks that can be way more damaging than you ever can imagine. But if you were still running your own truck, making $100,000 a year, it probably wouldn't even affect you very much. You may go from $100,000 to $80,000, let's say. But if you're a company that's got all this money going out and now you're making $400,000 and it stops, you're going to hemorrhage all that money because you have all that infrastructure. So the bigger something is, the more fragile it is. The smaller it is, normally, the more anti-fragile it is. So just keep that in mind when you're thinking about doing something like that. If you're in business and you understand the 80-20 rule, you're definitely going to be more anti-fragile. If you're a company that does not understand the 80-20 rule, which most companies, we're talking about trapping industry, do not understand what that really is in real life, you're going to be more fragile. You got 100% of time, you got 100% of resources, and all of a sudden you find out that, you know, what are you going to do? Where am I going to put my resources and my time? So you're starting off a business. And what happens most of the time is people don't understand the 80-20 rule, so they put 100% of time over 100% of different things, when only 20% of what they're doing is actually paying for the other 80% that they're floundering with, and it's not getting anywhere. And that 80% with any type of shock overtakes the 20% that you were making, because you still have these outlays of expense. But if you're a company that understands the 80-20 rule, maybe you only sell 2 brands of traps. That's it, because that's where 80% of your money's coming from. You only sell 3 different lure manufacturers, because that, when you look at your things, you realize 80% of my lure money's coming from these 3 or 4 guys. Why am I carrying the inventory on 60? Just so I can have it? You know, you can justify it in your mind or whatever. You look and you find out that you're selling, you know, 80% of your money on snare cables coming from 5/64 1x19, but you're buying these 5,000-foot rolls, and it takes you 4 years to get through them. You're wasting your resources and your time on the things that aren't making you money. And the same goes for your prices, what products you're carrying, how you're marketing. All of that needs to be based off an 80-20 rule. 20% makes 80% of the actual income in almost every business. Thinking linearly, planning too much, I promise you is fragile. It doesn't seem that way. It goes against what you were taught in school. I've never done a business plan, ever. Never. Because I don't know what the business is going to be in 6 months or a year or 2 years. I don't know. See, when I started in this, you could make really good money if you produce good DVDs, or at that time, VHSs. That's gone. If I would have stayed with that model, I wouldn't be here right now. I went and even switched that to the first person to ever do any type of night vision stuff. That's now commonplace on YouTube. That's gone. So if I planned about being the night vision guy, I'd be out of business. I played around with supplies. That was not my cup of tea. So I didn't know where I was going to go, where I was not going to go. So I concentrate on the lures, because that's where 80% of my money comes from. Not all this other stuff. Now, like I said, if you're looking at planning, if you're going to start a trapping business, this is where you get in trouble. If you get locked into a mission of what you think your business is, you'll bypass whatever it is that you don't know what it is, and I don't either, that's actually going to be your baby that's going to propel you further in income than you ever thought. If Coca-Cola would have stayed a pharmacy, it wouldn't be one of the most recognized brands in the world. See, that's what Coca-Cola started as a pharmacy. They just happened to sell some drinks over a counter. They had no idea. They had no plans on becoming a soft drink conglomerate worldwide. If you're using an iPhone or an MP3 player or an iPad, that came from a word processing computer company, Apple. No one even uses that product hardly for word processing anymore. But if they would have stuck with word processing, and the reason I'm telling you this, if you go back to, I started with DVDs or VHSs, and I would have been stuck on that, I couldn't have pivoted when I needed to. So how did I know that YouTube was going to become online, internet was going to come online, and destroy the DVD market? I didn't. Nobody did. It was a shock to the system. So I had to transfer. So 20 years ago, if you would have ever told me that we were going to move this much lure, I'd have laughed at you. For one, I didn't know that much lure was sold. You know, if you're getting into bad debt, that's going to be highly fragile because you have lots of payment. See, there's one thing, if you're going to be looking at fragile and anti-fragile, that I think is important, is you got to try your best to be honest with yourself. We were talking about business, or we're talking about trapping, either one. If you have to convince yourself you need something and it takes more than one reason, you're probably lying to yourself. You need a new truck. How do you convince yourself you need a new truck? Well, the other one's getting old, it's getting unreliable, it's this, that, and the other. And I'm not talking about a personal truck. I'm talking about for trapping or for business. It boils down pretty quick. Are you going to make money off of that? Is that truck going to make you money? If the answer to that is no, that's probably not very good debt. The last thing to keep in consideration, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, was Amazon. Businesses that built their whole business platform off Amazon in the trapping industry, they saw really quick how fragile their business model was. Because in a few clicks, Amazon wiped their business out. See, that's very fragile. Because if your whole platform is built on Amazon, what options do you have? None. So just keep all this in mind. Anti-fragile or fragile. There's just some ways that after reading this book that I, like I said, I'll admit I need some help with this because it seems simple and super complicated all at the same time. So let's click on time. I'm going to do one of these. Okay, this is the book I was just talking about, Scientific Coyote Trapping and Hunting by Wally E. Miles. Let me see when this bad boy was published. 1947, republished in 1947. Always use a scent only at sets where the coyotes will just be smelling around in sort of a bush or grass pen or along a bank, or he will have to go over the trap to smell the scent in the sand draw or in the plow. Always use food baits he will pick up, such as cracklings, chopped up meat, or hawk hide, so he will be he'll be walking around gathering them up. We've talked about this in the past, like using small chunks of liver and different things like that. Now this is what I found this very interesting when I was looking at this, because in 1947, this guy figured out this way before I did. He'll be walking around and gathering these up. Then always spread them lengthwise around the traps, that he will run back and forth from the traps where it is placed in more, let's see, where if placed in more of a large circle, they will go all around and not hit the traps nearly as often. So what he was doing is he used all these philosophies of these old guys are fascinating, the way that they went about different things. But the way Wally Miles was, is he believed, like flat sets, because he's a Western guy, you put just scent on your flat sets. And you put it in a way that the animal had to cross the trap to get to the scent. Kind of makes sense. Well, here's a different way of trapping that we just don't do anymore. It is very similar to the coyote stop that I make, but it is also more similar to actually a product that, if I put it on the market this year, it'll be called Carpet Bomb, where you use the habits of the animal against him in such a way that it's hard for him not to get caught. So let's say you're sitting there and you've got a trail, and the coyotes are going up and down this trail. And I'm picturing some of the places that I've been in Michigan with Jeff. You've got swamps on each side. It hasn't froze over yet. And then you have these trails that are across the road, and they will kind of stay on the high ground in between the real swampy areas. And there's always a trail there. So what does Jeff do? He blind sets those, and he catches coyotes with them. Well, here's just a different way of looking at doing this that's really old school, that you're not going to see on YouTube. But it's a very effective way. See, when I was down in Texas, I had a place that already had pressure on it, and the coyotes were tough in the footholds. So what I end up doing, and I've talked about this before, is I went down to the local mart. The Mexicans apparently eat a lot of kidneys because these all the grocery stores had a big selection of kidneys, and they're really cheap. So I cut these kidneys up in small chunks, probably about the size of a marble, just a regular shooting marble like when we were kids. Not big at all. And then I'd spend all night cutting these things up. And then I would put in my regular sets next to these trails these coyotes were going up and down, or they wouldn't even stop. So I would go out, you know, 5 or 10 feet in one direction, and I would throw out, you know, 5 or 6 pieces of this kidney just in a little grass here and a little bit, you know, cactus there. And I would just kind of walk them right into the trap, and I'd do the opposite thing on the other side. So I might have 30 feet of these small pieces of kidney just sitting on top of the ground. And you could watch the tracks. The first coyote coming up there would smell that kidney, and he would circle it, and he would do all kind of games. But as soon as he got that one piece, he would go to the next one quicker and quicker and quicker. Then it just turned into Easter egg hunting. Now, my mistake, if I would have read this book at that time, I would have done my set a lot different. The way Miles did it and the way I did it was, I was probably not as proficient as what he was doing. But what I noticed by putting out these small pieces of kidney up and down the trail is, and I would have some in the hole itself, along with bait and lure, is the coyotes would work that, and they would get less cautious. Then when they got up to the trap, a lot of them, they just walk right into the trap. But if the first thing they came to was the trap with the bait in it, they would treat it the same as what a lot of trappers see when they get upset with coyotes not working their sets. They treated it the same way that the small piece of kidney was on the very first time they came in contact with it, because they don't trust it. But after they trusted it a little more and a little more and a little more, it was really easy to get them in what I was wanting to, because you could almost see that it turned into an Easter egg hunt, and it was fun and it was free food. But the way Mr. Miles was doing it is different than the way I did it, and I think his way is probably better. He would put a couple of traps in the trail. If you read the book, which we'll probably cover more of this later, he's a big component of two traps. So let's say we put two traps in a trail. Well, we're going to spread them out, say they're 12 inches apiece. They can be 6, they could be 14, they could be 18. Don't complicate it. It doesn't really matter. And then if the trail goes north and south, just so we can stay on the same page, you start putting bait, you know, maybe 6 inches away from the trap, and he's using cracklings and different things like that. You could use kidneys, you could use whatever you wanted to. And then he would go and he'd put some more up north of that, a little bit more north of that, a little bit more north of that, a little bit more north of that. And then he would repeat this process on the south. This seems very childish. But what happens when the coyote comes there? If he's coming north or south, the first piece he comes to, he's not your dog. He's not going to come down and just bite it. He's going to check it out. He's going to try to wind it. He's going to circle it. He's going to scratch at it. The first one he picks up, he's usually just going to run away. The second one, he'll run away less. And then you have him where he's going up and down this trail trying to find his Easter eggs of your free bait. And in the middle of this, you've got two traps sitting that trail. Now, if all of your bait's right on the trail, he's going to effortlessly walk over your traps to continue his Easter egg hunt. It's a very brilliant way to use the habits of the coyotes against them. It's old school, it's not sexy. But it's definitely a way to get things to get where you want them to go. So he would have his traps in the middle, and he would have his baits on the outside kind of spread out. And trust me, when a coyote, even when he gets all those baits, he's going to run back and forth making sure he didn't miss any if he liked it. What's waiting in the middle of that trail? Two traps. If you were to do that with drags, you have a chance of catching a double. Pretty genius. It's pretty slick. It's like I said, it's not exactly sexy in modern day premises. But if you're having trouble getting stuff to stop at your sets, you have to ask yourself, is it the best way to go about this to keep repeating what I'm doing and trying to force the coyote to change to that? Or can you just switch what you're doing and let the coyotes do what they're already doing by blowing past you on the trail, and you're trying to pull them off the trail like I was doing, and just catch them in the trail, but now you can actually use something that will get him running back and forth on that trail a whole lot more. There's a little bit more preparation to do this type trapping. It's not something I would say I would do at every set. But if you got a coyote that's aggravating you because he just don't know the game that you want him to play, give him a different game. Use his habits against him. That's when it seems like things start clicking a little bit better. Because if you can switch him back and forth between standard dirt holes and flat sets and bait sets and sets like Mr. Miles is talking about, there's nothing fragile about that. No matter what you see, you've got an option sitting right there to be able to handle it. So I hope this helps somebody out there, and I will talk to y'all next week. Bye.